You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more. Today on our show, I'm talking with Richard Vine. Richard, thanks so much for being with me today.
It's my great pleasure.
So, Richard, we're going to talk about critical writings and curating and the magazine, of course, but to begin with, I want to talk about your novel, which we'll discuss, but if you could just introduce what the novel is and then read a passage from it.
The novel is called Soho Sins. It's set in the New York art world of the 1990s and narrated by a successful dealer named Jackson Wyeth. And that's probably all you need to know to set up this passage. This is the beginning of the second chapter. Once I sobered up in the morning, a question kept coming into my head. What is the normal way to react at the violent death of your spouse? Maybe there is no proper answer, really. Only the stunned, queer things we do automatically, because they seem expected, or, if not expected, inescapable, when the pain is new. Philip, as soon as he discovered his partner's body, jumbled and blood-soaked in the living room chair, walked into the local police station and offered a benumbed self-indictment. My name is Philip Oliver, and I believe I murdered my wife. That expression of grief might have seemed a little strange in other parts of town. But all this occurred south of Houston Street, back when Soho was the new art capital of the world. Though I'm sure of few things in life, I'm willing to bet that a dozen far more peculiar events took place in the neighborhood that day. They just weren't tied with any official crimes. In my gallery a few days later, I got a call from Hogan, who was already at work on the case. You're good buds with Philip Oliver, right? The husband? Sadly, yes. How well do you know him? Well enough to sell him second-rate paintings at first-rate prices. We're like brothers. There was a brief and indefinable noise at the other end. Are you trying to be a hard-ass about this? Maybe. I've had some pretty good lessons, thanks to you. Then my tone changed. Philip and I have been close for half my life. How would you like me to behave? You could deal with it straight. Maybe just remind me to stay out of your old pal category. Too late, Hogan, but don't worry. You won't be buying any Lucio Fontana monochromes on your lousy pay. No, not if my luck holds out. The line crackled for a moment. Screw you, Jack, and screw your money, too. As you can probably tell, Hogan and I go back a long way. We were restless boys together, bumbling through adolescence in a small town upstate. Eventually, a few years after hitting the city at 18, we went very different ways. Myself to the Institute of Fine Arts and the gallery business, Hogan to the Marines, and after the war, to the New York Police Department. Now he works as a private investigator. So you think this crazy man act of Oliver's is for real, he asked. It's been going on for 2 years. Sure, but is the guy clever enough to fake it in order to throw us off as a suspect? I thought he confessed. That's right. Marched into the first precinct out of the rain, went straight up to the intake counter and started blathering. McGuinn let him inside, and the rich fool signed a statement. Thing is, the story rambles all over the place, and half the details don't match what the cops found on the crime scene. What did they find? This Amanda, his wife. She was a friend of yours, too? Of course. A good-looking woman? For her age? Then you don't want to know. I waited. Silence, I learned long ago, is Hogan's principal form of mercy. In his line of work, he has a lot to keep mum about. She was shot in the back of the head with a couple of soft-nosed slugs, he said finally. Twice? At a slight downward angle. The bullets flattened and blew out through her forehead and left cheek. All right, I get the picture. I could show you the photos, but I don't think you'd enjoy them. Something inside me seemed to falter and drop. Against my own wishes, I thought about Mandy on the warm fall night. I watched her, her sharp bones flashing as she danced with the white-haired raconteur Victor Borge after a dinner party at the Danish consul's apartment on Fifth Avenue. The lights had been lowered, and we could see the dark treetops of Central Park beyond the stone rim of the balcony. Windows in the far high-rises glowed yellow like heirloom gold above the thick black branches. I watched Mandy again in that ivory silk dress, laughing at the old man's jokes as she danced, her green eyes welling with tears. And then I tried not to think about her delicate face anymore.
Thank you, Richard. Mm-hmm. So this is your first novel?
Yes. After many years of doing, you know, art criticism, it just felt like a rejuvenating experience to try something.
So I want to ask you a few things about it. The cover of it, which I'm looking at now, and hopefully we'll reproduce in the interview, looks like a classic Pulp Fiction cover. Who was the artist, and where did that come from?
It is indeed. It was done by Richard McGuire, who was one of the classic pulp illustrators from the 50s, and the publisher obtained permission from his daughter to use a painting that was left after his demise, and it plays upon all of the conventions of noir fiction: the dark alleyway, the hot babe in a red dress, the looming, benighted protagonist.
And the writing itself plays on those conventions as well.
Yeah, many years ago, before I ever got involved in the art world, I did a PhD at the University of Chicago in contemporary American fiction. And I wrote about John Barth, an experimental novelist, who in, I think it was 1967, published an essay called The Literature of Exhaustion, in which he argued that essentially everything that can be done in narrative fiction has been done at some point, if you know your history, if you've done enough reading. And so how do you deal with that dilemma as a new writer? And his answer was, you take these old established forms, these conventions, and you use them outright. But of course, you're using them as a postmodernist, in fact, which means that they're always a little bit in quotation marks. And the very use of the conventions creates its own effect in addition to, the narrative arc of the story. So I was very attracted to that idea.
And that's what framed this particular work, and also the 90s, the 90s art world, which is, we'll be talking about your actual experience in that soon, but this is the world that you're in. You are in that area. You're living in the city. We're in the city now, and you're that's
my office is in Soho. I go there every day. Have for 28 years now. It's an era that's rapidly receding. Younger people in the art world today, younger people on the Art in America staff, can scarcely imagine what what it was like in those days of old drafty lofts and going to the mud club and such things. They have their own world, of course, largely based on social media or driven by social media.
But within this novel, there's a lot of elements of 90s art world New York.
Yes, it's a mix of references to actual people and events, along with things that are completely fabricated. So, you have these imaginary characters going to real events like Bob Flanagan's birthday performance at the New Museum, or a Ron Athey performance, or an Anselm Kiefer show at MoMA.
That were actually happening.
Yes, they actually did happen, right.
Right. So how do you think of the 90s? And maybe this will segue into your writing and career. The 90s as a heady time in the art world, Soho, as opposed to the 80s, and then, of course, comparing it with now. But the 80s I've heard talked about as, this was a kind of a kind of peak of the decade, of the century. That's how Todd Levin talked about it. You know, there are these amazing artists, David Warnerovich and so many others that we lost to AIDS and you know, and some not, but still it was a kind of a golden age. I mean, I don't know if it was or not, or just we perceive things like that. Then there's the 90s, and then there's now. I don't know, comparing those decades, 80s, 90s, and now, and again, I guess in the context of the book and your experience, how do you see their differences? Is there this kind of, you know, sea change that was happening?
Well, maybe you have to go back one more decade and refer to the 70s.
Right. Where it all came from.
Yeah, and where people had multiple reasons for doing their art. Few of them connected with money at that time. You know, people may work out of political convictions or, you know, out of psychological need. there was a real community, mostly impoverished, but very genuine, perhaps more genuine for that very reason. And then in the 80s, you had the arrival of the star system and the beginnings of the kind of art world that we live in now. You know, in about 1990, you had a market bust and a kind of setback, but then throughout the 90s, it built again. And one of the things I do here is to kind of project backwards a little bit. That is, I take the obsession with money.
Which you feel began in the 90s.
Well, actually in the 80s, from the late 80s to, yeah. And I make it a little more intense than it probably was at that era, so as to better reflect the circumstances now. and to ask, in effect, you know, what are the ramifications of that? What happens? And, of course, you know, it's a... I keep referring to it as a form of corruption. And sort of my central metaphor for that is a young girl character in the novel, a child, really, like 12 years old, who obliquely represents new artists. Because as you know, the art world, particularly today, particularly with the dominance of the market, is all about finding the next star. You know, fresh blood. And, you know, people are often taken up very early in their careers, milked for a few years, and then dropped. So I thought to myself, well, you know, how could you apply that to a parallel situation? And that's where we get into some very bizarre territory in the middle of the book. Because one of my other considerations was that in most crime fiction, the murder victim is just a marker. It's kind of, you know, the corpse is a token at the beginning of the story to set things in motion. But you don't have much of a emotional connection with that victim. And consequently, you don't feel the full force of the evil. I wanted the readers to feel the full force of evil. And that's why I then put the young girl in jeopardy.
And without making a spoiler, when we talk about the full force of evil, that's very intriguing. When you talk about evil and its full force, I mean, you can say whatever you want about the book, but what do you mean by that, or how do you define evil, if I can ask that?
Well, in this case, you know, it has to do with the corruption of innocence. And the way I attempt to bring it home is to, you know, to have this figure threatened by certain external forces that are at work in the art world, and putatively under the protection of the narrator, Jackson, or Jack. But as things go along, you begin to have suspicions about Jack himself, or concerns that he may be unable to resist crossing certain lines that we all hope he will not. it's a way of personifying a certain moral dilemma.
And is it at all an analogy for, and just stop me if that's a reach, but of the art world or a loss of innocence
from
the 80s or 90s
to
now?
Hopefully not heavy-handed. Hopefully it's not screaming that, and I think many people have read the book and not even necessarily made that connection, that parallel. But it was certainly in my mind.
So you've been writing for a while now. To talk about your writing, critical writing and also the magazine Art in America. When did just to start back a little bit, and I want to talk about current curating and writing and what's happening with the magazine. But when did you start writing for the magazine?
I came to New York in 1988, and started working there and writing soon after.
And so that's part of obviously the lens that you've seen all of this through. Yeah. So over the years, you're continuing to write. You're your writer and also a contributing editor,
managing editor
now. Mm-hmm. How has the magazine changed over all that time? Because was it Art in America that 7 Days in the Art World also that Thornton discussed, or maybe that was Art. not a good reference, but how has the magazine changed over that time, or how you've been writing over that time? Because sometimes I talk to critics, and everybody seems to have a different idea of what a critic does, or how he or she approaches their writing or practice. Is it for checks and balances? Is it a kind of to help readers understand how to look at art? So I guess I'm asking how you approach your writing, and especially for all these years for the magazine. Yeah.
Well, when I arrived, the magazine was headed by Elizabeth Baker, Betsy, who eventually spent 35 years as editor-in-chief, and had a very clear editorial vision. And the phrase that we always lived with in those days was the magazine of record. And so we sought to have a mix of very contemporary material, some historical material, some newsy material, some opinion-driven material.
Like the New York Times, is that kind of approach.
Yeah,
to a record,
no? Right. Since then, of course, we've all experienced the onslaught of the internet and social media and blogs. Which has arguably forced many publications to try to be more timely. Everyone respected and many people loved Art in America in those days, but they always had that little complaint, but your reviews come out 9 months after the show. There was that sort of thing. Because we were still thinking of ourselves as presenting reflective criticism, right?
Long form, more thoughtful.
Long form, and the idea of judiciousness was very significant at the time. Now it's very hard to maintain that, and every print publication is very aware that these other digital forms are out there, speaking to people the same day the show opens. And so these days there's a much greater emphasis on what's happening right now, who are the names on everyone's lips this week,
But how can that come out this week? I mean, it's still a print magazine,
right? Well,
it's online, because that is a very curious transition. How do you compete with that when it isn't the Huffington Post? It's not about the latest thing online. It's still a print publication,
right? Yeah. Well, we have our weekly editorial meetings, and we talk about who and what we should cover. So it's very much like what is taking the preponderance of public attention at this moment, this week, and you know, hopefully, you know, 4 or 6 or 8 weeks from now, we'll have a major piece on that phenomenon, whatever it is.
Yeah. Interesting, and throughout this time also, because this does seem to be a sort of a very big change in how publications work. I've also talked to writers who, you know, once wrote for magazines like Art in America or others, and the pay scale has also changed dramatically. Writers who were one time making a living working for different art publications can't even come close to making a living now. Well, what happened there? What is that about?
Well, what happened was that the internet publications pay nothing or $50 for an article, you know. And, you know, there are so many people desiring to be part of the game, to be, you know, part of the art world, that they're willing to do that, to write for free.
So it's become much more competitive because of the internet and everything else, and the amount of writers is so much more competitive.
Yeah. Yeah, and the nature of the writing has changed. You know, there's a higher emphasis on immediate opinion,
Which means
as
comments.
Opposed to reflective judgment.
You
know?
Mean comments, likes, that kind of thing. Immediate opinion.
Well, yeah, sort of.
I mean, does that play into a lot? Because, of course, that's also the big change in the last several years, right? Is how many comments does something generate? How many, you know? And really, it seems to me the only way something generates a lot of comments is for it to be
snarky.
Yeah, snarky. Right. It's become kind of snarky, you know. Like, I saw a piece the other day. It was something about Christos, and you know, what an empty gesture, you know, that he did about something, and it made me comment because I thought, you know, what are you talking about? you're missing some history there. But but I would imagine that was also the intention of the writer to be that way. So is that a big? Is that what you mean by that kind of reaction? That there's also this focus on comments and readers.
Yeah. I mean, you know, not so long ago, you know, the magazine went out. You know, a couple of weeks later, you would be out at openings or at dinner parties, and someone would say to you, "Oh, I saw the article you guys did on such and so. I really thought it was this or that." Or now, when you're putting materials online, you know, you have analytics daily if you want them, which tells you immediately how many people are looking at which stories for how long. And although, you know, you don't want to just be led by the nose by that kind of information, of course it has a certain effect, that it seeps in.
It's hard not to, isn't it? I mean, I want to talk about your curating too, but it's all, this seems like an issue with media in general. You know, before the election, it struck me that Trump was at the top of the news every single day. I mean, New York Times, whatever it was, AP, BBC, top of the world news. And at that time I thought, Jesus, this guy is spending nothing on his campaign, and he's getting extraordinary press. Hillary's way down there. There's nothing to write about Hillary. Right. And, you know, as much as it seems kind of a double bind, because at the same time that same press hated him and everything, but that was what was if I'm understanding what you're saying right, that's, if we look at the analytics, that's where everyone's spending their time. Trump said what about who, and so we all go there.
And suddenly he's setting the conversation, you know.
right
instead of, you know, being ignored, which was what he deserved.
So what is that, what's the direction of media because of that? Obviously it sounds like that takes in everything, Huffington Post, Art in America, everything then begins to have to operate in order, you know, in order to kind of answer to those analytics. I don't know, what's the future of that? That sounds a bit dark.
I mean, we're protected a little bit because, you know, we have a private owner. And because, you know, an art magazine is a niche publication, So you're not necessarily driven by, you know, mass numbers, like, a general circulation magazine really has to follow the numbers or they cease to exist. So we're a little bit betwixt and between, you know,
You still have some leeway.
An academic journal that's, you know, protected by Harvard University and is going to do what it does no matter what. And we're not exactly, you know, Better Housekeeping where we have to, you know, speak to the hugest numbers. So it's a complicated situation to be in.
And at the moment at the magazine, you're writing and also the managing editor. So what are your... responsibilities there?
We have just a small number of people, you know, like 8 editors, so it's very collegial. Essentially we have one boss, the editor-in-chief, and then everyone else is the team. So we all work together. Each of us with slightly different roles. My particular role is to see that, you know, her vision or what she decides for a given issue is realized, which in practical terms has a lot to do with sort of overseeing the edits, making sure that things are moving along, making sure that there's no major problems in any of the stories, editing a few pieces myself, occasionally writing something myself.
And that the whole issue reflects the vision of the editor for that issue as well.
Yeah. A vision that she comes to in consultation with
her
editors. Yeah, right. It's not that she's arbitrarily imposing it. It's, you know, the vision that has developed out of our editorial meetings leading up to any particular issue. Yeah.
And so at the same time, you're curating?
Very little, but I have done some. In conjunction with the novel, I co-curated a show recently at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, which was a show of art dealing with murder.
That's exciting. So tell me a little bit about that show, because that does feed in nicely
with
the novel.
And one of the participants was Jonathan Santoffler. I don't know if you know him. He was an artist for many years. And then had a disastrous fire where he lost the majority of his best work and sort of found himself at loose ends. And sort of said, you know, what can I do now? And he wrote a crime novel, which became a bestseller. And he's now done about 6 of them. So I organized a panel with him and with Carter Ratcliffe, who is known primarily as an art critic, but who recently did this book, Tequila Mockingbird, which deals with Russian oligarchs, narrated in the persona of a vapid young fashion model. Great job of ventriloquism on Carter's part. So we had a very nice discussion that night. The show had works, you know, sometimes portraying murder scenes directly, sometimes very obliquely, terms of, you know, objects that have been associated with crime or what have you. What else?
In China?
Years ago, I think it was 2013, I did a show of 10 artists at the National Art Museum of China in Beijing, and that was 5 Chinese artists and 5 American artists dealing with the theme of darkness. And the show is called Darkness Visible. Stealing a phrase from Milton. And I was intrigued by it because the color or non-color of black has slightly different connotations in each culture. And I was interested in that dialogue. So the American artists were Chikaya Booker, Rashid Johnson, Ray Smith, who's a Mexican-American artist, and Joyce Panzato, and Robert Longo.
That's exciting. So there's some curating now, and you're continuing to write. Is there any other projects that we should...
Yeah,
mention.
I've also sort of curated a show for an Icelandic sculptor that I know well, but in Delhi, India.
Who's the Icelandic sculptor?
Guðjón Bjarnason is his name. He's both a sculptor and an architect, who, oddly, in recent years has moved to India and is living and working there now, doing architectural projects all over the country. And he had a retrospective at the National Academy in New Delhi. And so I was a co-curator on that. So, you know, a few things like that as they come up. But, you know, the vast majority of my time goes into, you know, working for the magazine and then my own writing.
Do you have another novel planned? Is
it? Yeah, in the works.
Crime.
Another crime novel, but more political, not about the art world directly. Dealing with a political crime that I witnessed in real life. I don't know if you remember the Kent State killings. Mm-hmm. 1970. That was my school. I was in that demonstration. I saw those 9 people wounded and 4 people killed when the National Guard opened fire on a group of unarmed students.
Oh my God! So you were there when they were actually killed?
Yes. Yeah. It's something that has weighed on me for many years, as you can imagine.
Because you could have been killed there too.
I mean, well, there's that. It. Yes. But also just, you know, as someone who writes, you sort of feel like, you know, dude, you've got to, you were there, you've got to say something about this. So I'm wrangling with that now.
So without going into the book too much and to touch on that a little bit, that is a kind of extraordinary point in history, to actually be there. As you've thought about it for these years, or as you say, it weighs on you. What is it exactly that weighs on you in regard to that? I mean, it was an extraordinary time, of course, and you know, that one event, I suppose, set all kinds of things in motion because it was so upsetting. I remember reading an article in the Times quite a while ago. I don't know if you saw this, but it was about had a picture of the students who had died, that famous image, and she said, that boy that was shot right there who died, that was my son. And it was just, it was so upsetting, but also, you know, of course, really brings it home, like, oh my God, right, this was somebody's kid that was at college, and how could this be? So, so how do you see that now, in 2016, looking back?
You know, there are a couple of things that are really on many things, but two of the things that are very haunting about that event is that there are really some unsolved mysteries. A lot of people don't realize that there was a whole weekend of confrontations before the shootings. And that on Saturday of that weekend, there was a campus building, an old barracks that had been converted to the headquarters for ROTC, you know, the Reserve Officers Training, which was burned down. And that event really occasioned the calling in of the National Guard. To this day, no one knows who burned that building down. There are those who think, well, it was just radical students. There are those who think, you know, it sounds like conspiracy theory, but it's not infeasible that it could have been agent provocateurs, you know, working with the FBI or whatever. But we don't know. We also don't know if the National Guard received an order to fire or if the soldiers simply did this on their own. And if they did it on their own, did they do it out of panic or did they do it out of vindictiveness?
That's never been known. The soldiers haven't talked. Nobody knows what happened.
No one will talk in a way that is convincing. you know, the story they put out first was that, you know, they fired because they felt their lives were at risk and their, you know, hordes of hundreds of students coming at them with baseball bats and... Well, you know, I was standing there. I know that's not the case. And it's since been documented through films, through photographs, et cetera, et cetera, that that is utterly false story. and that most of the people shot were, you know, like two-thirds of a football field away.
Wow, they were that far away.
Mm-hmm.
So that's almost like a sniper range.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to imagine.
Yeah.
They were shot with a normal rifle, or I mean, that's
M1 military rifle. most of them. I mean, the guard also fired shotguns and 45 caliber pistols, and so people were hit with various kinds of munitions. But
all at quite a distance.
Yeah, I think 60 feet was the closest.
Well, yeah, that's very upsetting, and look forward to your next book.
Yeah, yeah.
Before we go, I just want to ask you the question I ask everybody at the end: what is it that you're reading now? Can you share that with us? You could. Grab a book if you want and come back, or if you know, off the topic, anything at all.
Yeah. You know, I tend to keep several things going at once. Oddly enough, I never used to read much crime fiction, but now I do from time to time to sort of, you know, keep myself aware. And I'm reading an old classic now, Mildred Pierce, James M. Cain. Rereading The Stranger, Camus' The Stranger. And Camus was very aware of James N. Cain and once said something very complimentary about him. So it's interesting to sort of, because, you know, the Stranger is about this apparently unmotivated crime, the killing of an Arab on the beach. Whereas one is, you know, Pulp Fiction and one is classic literature. So it's interesting to read them in parallel. I hate to utter the name, but the fact is I've also been looking at some of Bill O'Reilly's books, these history books, where this one's called Killing Lincoln, Killing Kennedy, because he has a rather interesting technique where he uses a series of short passages, almost cinematic. You know, all of the events leading up to the principal event, and I find that useful and invigorating. I mean, if you read some straight history, you can get bogged down in detail very easily. You know, exploring alternative ways.
Richard, I want to thank you for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure.
Yeah, it's been very fun, and I'm delighted.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.